grade is 50, otherwise I'm in the wrong place. Let me tell you a little bit about the course. So my name is Jaume Gomis. I'm a faculty member at PI, and my office, I think, is 456 in the other building. And my research is basically on basic aspects of quantum field theory and string theory. And what is this course about? So the course will be an introduction to the ADS CFT correspondence. Maybe before I go a little bit further, I mean, has everyone or anyone heard about this, the buzzword before, ADS CFT correspondence? Yes? Do I need to teach the course or no? Yeah, okay. Yeah, so this is really a truly remarkable correspondence that I guess was first sharply formulated now slightly over 10 years ago that it's literally has taken over the whole world of theoretical physics, and we will see why. It's really a remarkable way of studying at the same time quantum gravity and strongly coupled field theories of the type that we use to describe elementary particle physics or condensed matter systems, etc. So the course will be divided, roughly speaking, into three blocks. Number one, I'll introduce you to the basics of the ADS CFT correspondence, or more generally, the fascinating relation that exists between gauge theories of the type that we use to describe the standard model of particle physics or some condensed matter physics, and string theory, which at least I know you have a cursory understanding, given that you have a three-week lecture just prior to this course. So for the first week, the main thing I'll want to do is first show you why is it not completely crazy that the gauge theory, a particular expansion of a gauge theory, the Lagrangian expansion, which I'm going to start describing today, can possibly be equivalent to a string theory. This sounds like a crazy statement because, as you've seen in the string theory course, a string theory is a theory that contains gravity, while gauge theories, the standard gauge theories that describe Young-Mills-like theories, like the ones that describe the standard model, have no gravity in it. There is no graviton. What you have is spin one particles, the gluons, the photons, and so on, and they couple to matter fields like quarks, electrons. And the statement of this correspondence is that a certain class of gauge theories are completely equivalent to studying string theory or quantum gravity. And this is a very powerful tool because if this is true, you can use this correspondence in two ways. You can use it in this way to solve the gauge theory to learn about quantum gravity, which we don't know very much about. The string theory, the usual approach to string theory that you've heard in the last 3 weeks, is a perturbative approach to quantum gravity, where you define quantum gravity as an expansion, as a perturbative expansion. But we don't really know what the complete definition of quantum gravity is. And this is a possible approach. And the other way around is also very interesting. Even if you don't care about quantum gravity, which is a fine point of view to take, because it's probably not very of direct relevance for present experiments. But if you use this correspondence, you can also learn a lot about strongly coupled gauge theories. So by doing some semi-classical gravity of the type that you've been studying in the lectures, by doing kind of a simple computation in semi-classical gravity, you can learn remarkable things about strongly coupled gauge theories. These are theories that we essentially have no tools to study because perturbation theory breaks down. There is no small parameter. But by doing a simple computation here, you can solve this problem. And this has had lots of applications to the quark gluon plasma, to condensed matter physics, to non-relativistic strongly coupled systems, and so on. So this is really a very rich correspondence that even no matter what your main interest is, it might have a direct impact, namely because you can use it to study quantum gravity or because you want to use it to study strongly coupled theories that appear in particle physics, condensed matter physics, etc. So in the first week, hopefully, I'll try to give you the basic tools to motivate where this correspondence might possibly true. And what are the what's the basic dictionary? We have to provide a tool that tells you that how to relate quantities in one theory to quantities in the other one. That's one of the basic things that we have to do. It should be said that this correspondence, even though it's very strong, there is very strong motivations for it, is not really proven in the mathematical sense of the word. So I won't be able to prove for you that this correspondence is correct. But what we'll see is that it fits in a kind of consistent physical picture that allows you to calculate things, which is what physics is most about, to try to understand and calculate things. It should be said that there are toy models of this correspondence between string theory and gauge theories, which we can actually prove. And the hope is that the techniques that have been used to prove this gauge-string correspondence for the toy models would ultimately lead us to the proof for the actual ADS-CFTs that we're going to use. In the second week, essentially what you'll be introduced to is to the use of the techniques of integrability in ADS-CFT. These are very powerful tools that allows you to calculate very precisely some very interesting observables, both on the gauge theory and the string theory, and compare them. And this gives you very strong clues about the validity of the correspondence. And then in the last week, now that you have the tools, the general picture, and some of the techniques, you'll be introduced to certain applications to physical systems. So in particular, you will see how you can use the tools of ADS-CFT to study the physics of strongly coupled systems like QCD and the quark gluon plasma. Okay, any questions about kind of the big where we're going? Is that where you wanted to go, or do you want to go somewhere else? No? Okay. Okay. So let's start. Since probably of you have at least heard the basic setup of ADS-CFT, I didn't want to go through a kind of a long explanation of what the statement of the duality is and just jump into to business. But maybe for the, if there is anyone that hasn't seen it, I'll just give a maybe 5-minute kind of summary of what the basic idea is. So the basic idea in this context, it should be said that these correspondences between gauge theories and string theories go beyond the example of the ADS-CFT correspondence, but in this course we will focus mainly in the example of the ADS-CFT correspondence because it's the one that we understand by far the most. But the basic idea is of the ADS-CFT correspondence goes under the rubric of a holographic correspondence. So let me just throw you a few buzzwords. Everything I'm going to say now will be essentially explained in much more detail later in the week, but just to give you a flavor or where the statements are. What the thing we want to do is study quantum gravity in a space-time that is asymptotically anti-de Sitter. Anti-de Sitter space is the maximally symmetric space with a negative cosmological constant, and intuitively should think of it as a box. In fact, you can think of it as a solid cylinder. And even though the proper distance between any point on the boundary is infinite, propagation of any signal from any point in the ball to the boundary takes finite time, so it really behaves like a cavity. If I shine a laser, if I was in ADS space and I shone a laser over there, by the end of the lecture it would be back if the curvature of the space was strong enough. So physically it behaves like a cavity. And here we have, in general, quantum gravity. So you can study any possible excitation of gravity inside this box. You can have black holes. You can have create black holes by collapsing matter. You can have graviton scattering. You can have any of the usual physical things that the theory of gravity has. But of course, we don't know what quantum gravity is in general. But what we know is what the physics that describes gravity in the box is in the semi-classical approximation. So in the semi-classical approximation, which means when curvatures are small, so let me ask you, what is the description of gravity when the curvatures are small? What is the theory that describes the leading order interactions of a spin to particle?
Here.
General relativity. So that means that the leading semi-classical approximation, you're going to have an action, which is going to be general relativity. So imagine the bulk of the box is d plus one dimensional. So you're going to have d plus one dimensional Einstein gravity. So this is the metric in the bulk. R is the curvature, the Ricci scalar. But now we're in a theory where we have anti-de Sitter space. I will explain much more carefully what anti-de Sitter is later in the course. But essentially, is anti-de Sitter space is a solution of Einstein's equations when you have a negative cosmological constant. So it means that you add to the usual curvature term a cosmological constant term. So this is the leading behavior. This is the term that dominates when the curvatures are very small. Now, as the curvatures get very large, which is what interests us for quantum gravity, like, for example, when you go to a singularity or when a black hole collapses, this theory has corrections. It could be higher derivative corrections. It could be quantum gravity corrections, etc. Now, in this theory, apart from having a graviton propagating the bulk, you could also have other matter fields. You could have scalar fields propagating here. You could have fermions, whatever you want. Essentially, what matter fields live here will depend on the details. Yes?
Sorry, why are we using the five-dimensional Newton's constant?
Oh, sorry. So this would be the d plus one dimensional Newton's constant. Thank you. So you can have all kinds of matter fields propagating the bulk, and that will depend on the details of what string theory we are considering. You have to quantize the string theory in that background and learn what the low energy fields of the theory are. And the correspondence now is that everything that can happen in this box, even in the regime where the semi-classical gravity approximation breaks down, in which we essentially have no computational tools, that would be the kind of the quantum gravity regime. Everything that can happen here is captured by a theory that lives at the boundary of this cylinder. So you could think of this cylinder as a can of soup, and all the information about what happened inside the soup, you could put on a label outside the cylinder. And what lives in the boundary of this cylinder is the d-dimensional, because now I've moved to the boundary of a d plus one-dimensional space, so the space is in one dimension less, because I have to fix one coordinate. I get a d-dimensional gauge theory. And by this, I mean a theory without gravity. So the statement is that any physical question that you can ask about gravity in anti-de Sitter space has a corresponding counterpart that can be formulated in terms of a quantum field theory in one dimension less that doesn't contain gravity. That's the statement. And the statement is that this correspondence is exact, which means that for any observable that you can define on the boundary theory, yes?
Thinking of anti-de Sitter space, d plus one-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, as a hyperboloid embedded in a d plus two-dimensional space.
Yeah.
So can you perhaps relate that picture to the cylinder you've drawn?
Yes, so we'll do that much more carefully. Okay. This picture is a picture of what's called global ADS space, which is a particular parameterization of the ADS hyperboloid. And what I wrote the boundary here, where the field theory lives, is what's called the conformal boundary. So if I give you a metric, there is a notion of the conformal boundary of the space, which essentially is the space where distances go to infinity. So we will see very carefully how the cylinder emerges from a parameterization of the hyperboloid. ADS space is, in some sense, you could think, you know how to parameterize a sphere by embedding it in one dimension higher, use the sum of x squared equals 1. Anti de Sitter space, you put a couple of minus signs here and there, and that's it's like a negatively curved surface. Another, the crazy statement about this duality is that any observable that you can dream up in the bulk theory or boundary theory should have a counterpart in the other theory. So one of the big challenges in this correspondence is actually to find the dictionary. If you construct for me an observable in the boundary theory, say, you have to identify which bulk observable corresponds to it. So that if you want to compute a certain property of that observable, you would know how to translate into the bulk language and vice versa. Okay. I don't want to go too much longer with this kind of big picture because it would involve throwing you buzzwords that you're probably not familiar with. So I rather, maybe later in the week, we'll come back. And now that we will know much more about what ADS means, what CFT means, and what the Lagrangian expansion is, we will go back and kind of think together what the statement of the correspondence really is and how amazing it actually is. So the first question that you might want to wonder is, how could it be that the gauge theory of the type that describes the strong interactions could possibly have anything to do with the string theory? They look completely different. I mean, Yang-Mills theories are written in terms of point-like variables. They're gluons and quarks. What does this have to do with a theory of extended objects like string theory? And the first hint of this correspondence arose in a truly remarkable paper by Tuft, where she essentially shows, which we'll go over this now, she essentially shows how if you study gauge theories in the Lagrangian expansion, we will miraculously discover that the structure of perturbation theory of the gauge theory in this limit looks exactly the same as the type of perturbative expansion that you've seen in string theory. Now, this connection doesn't tell you which string theory corresponds to a particular Lagrangian limit of a field theory. And that's where some extra insight was needed. And that's where Maldacena kind of had a brilliant insight using the physics of brains to actually identify, given a set of gauge theories, whether the corresponding bulk string theory is. Okay. Are people familiar with gauge theories? Do they know what they are? Yes? Should I review anything or? No? Okay. We'll see. We'll see if you need to review something. Okay, so his motivation, and this was introduced by, as I said, by Tuff. But it should be said that this idea of introducing a Lagrangian expansion is something that has found applications in many areas of physics, including particle physics, condensed matter physics, statistical mechanics. Because essentially the idea is to modify a theory such as to introduce a new expansion parameter in the theory that allows you to calculate. So essentially the Tuff what did is to introduce an expansion parameter for Young-Mills theories. Or QCD in particular. I mean, he was interested in QCD, the theory of the strong interactions. And he wanted to see whether this theory could be modified in a way that we could calculate things. Are people familiar with Young-Mills theories? OK, yes. So now, naively, you would say, well, Young-Mills theory has an expansion parameter. It has the coupling constant. But one of the things that you have learned in the previous course is that Young-Mills theories, or QCD in general, do not have an expansion parameter. Can anyone say why? Excuse me? But so why does that happen?
The coupling takes on the energy scale, the Stanley coupling, coupled scale.
Okay, that's exactly correct. So what happened is that in the classical theory, naively, when you write down the Lagrangians, maybe I should, for the benefit of if anyone is too shy to not want to mention that this is a bit unfamiliar. This is the simplest Lagrangian of Young-Mills theory. We're not adding any matter to this. Now, this looks simple. Why haven't we solved this? Look at this. Looks so simple, but it's very complicated. What does that mean? So this is essentially a generalization to matrices, where F, mu, nu is an n-by-n metric of the Lagrangian of electromagnetism. So that F, mu, nu is the curve of a gauge field. And here I introduce the coupling constant of the theory. It goes something like that. Now, this theory naively has a coupling constant, G. And this coupling constant, physically, what it does is measures the strength of the interaction as three gluons come together. The strength of this interaction is proportional to G. You can read that immediately from the Feynman rules of this theory. F multiplies this term with two gauge fields. And when you square F square, you're going to get the term that multiplies the commutator with the derivative here. So this is a vertex that has three incoming gluons coming out, coming in. And it's proportional to G. Okay. But now, one of the important properties of gauge theories and of most quantum field theories is the idea of dimensional transmutation. And this encapsulates the basic idea that the coupling constant is not a constant at all. It's a parameter that depends on the energy scale at which you probe the theory. Okay? So G is a function of Q. Q is some fiducial energy scale. So what happens, the reason that G is not a good expansion parameter is that, in particular for Young-Mills, which is asymptotically free. So remember that Young-Mills theories are asymptotically free. This is the statement that the coupling constant runs with the energy scale, but in the direction that as you go to very low energies, this coupling constant becomes large, and the expansion parameter in terms of Feynman diagram completely breaks down. Okay? So if you want to study the physics of nuclear physics, the physics of hadrons, where it's exactly the energy scale where this coupling constant of QCD is large, you cannot use perturbation theory because this coupling is of order one. Okay? So that's why we say that Young-Mills theories don't really have a coupling constant. You can use reliably perturbation theory if you study very high energy processes, but if you want to study the formation of nuclei, you cannot use perturbation theory. The fact that the coupling constant runs with the energy is a consequence, and I believe you've seen this in previous courses, of the renormalization group equation, which is the equation that tells you yes.
I was just wondering, because I thought that perturbation series of Feynman diagrams were only asymptotic and that they diverged anyways.
Yes.
So what's the difference if G is large or small?
Well, even if the perturbation theory is asymptotic, if G is small and you keep a finite number of terms, this could be a good approximation to the true answer. Here, even what you mean by the expansion doesn't make sense. It's like doing perturbation theory when the parameter is never small.
Okay.
In practice, we don't know how to resum all Feynman diagrams. So here, the whole notion of expanding doesn't really make sense at all. So now we have this coupling that runs with the energy scale, and this is encapsulated in the renormalization group equation, which tells you the flow equation for the coupling. It tells you that the derivative of the coupling with respect to the logarithmic scale of the energy. Actually, what is this thing called in field theory? When you look at the coupling constant of the theory and you take the logarithmic derivative, so this is the beta function, which I understand you've computed in multiple ways. So for Young-Mills theories, this is proportional to, actually, let me put a square here. It's proportional to g to the fourth, 32 pi squared, V naught, where V naught is the number that depends on the details of the field theory. Okay. How did you calculate this in your previous lectures? Can anyone tell me? Okay. So do you compute it with diagram, for example? So which diagram would you need to compute to extract this quantity?
Tidepole?
Sorry?
Is it the tidepole diagram?
Not really.
It's the fish.
The way you would compute it, or one way of computing it, would be to look at the kinetic term of the Gibbs field. You can always write the Lagrangian of Young-Mills in such a way that the naive coupling constant sits outside. You have trace F minus square. Okay. Now, G square multiplies everything, in particular the propagator of the theory. The propagator is the part of the action that is quadratic on the fields. So usually when you have an action, you expand it in the number of fields. You have a quadratic term, you have a cubic term, and in Young-Mills theory you also have a quartic term. So one way you can compute the running of the coupling is by saying, what is the modification due to quantum effects to the propagator of the theory? So for Young-Mills theory, and the propagator, remember, is this wavy line. Now, I already said that in Young-Mills theories, you have the cubic coupling constant. So the way you can calculate this flow is by seeing how the effect of these vertices change the effective propagator. So to this, we would add, for example, this diagram, where you have a gluon coming in You pair create a pair of gluons, they annihilate, and they come back. And now this diagram will have to be renormalized. And that's exactly how you're going to get this quantity. Okay. Now, and this is true for any gate theory. If I had matter coupled to it, so this was just a theory that has gluons. Imagine I had some matter fields, say fermions. Coupled to it. The running of the coupling would be also affected by the interaction of gluons with fermions, because from this Lagrangian, you can immediately read off that apart from the cubic vertex that we had, oh, this blackboard is nice. We also have this one where you have a quark. You can read this from here. You have two quarks, maybe you should call it Q, that couple, remember the covariant derivative. Couples to the gate field. Okay, so if you have a quark, you could transform like this. Think of A's, MU's as matrices, and Q's as column vectors. We have like that. So it means that there is a cubic vertex here because you have MU Q times Q bar. So you have a vertex like this. You have Q, Q bar, and you have a gluon coming in. So if you want to compute, what you can see immediately is that this vertex will modify the behavior of the propagator at what's called one loop, yes? Well, so right now, we're in four dimensions. Okay. It's only in four dimensions that the coupling constant runs logarithmically with the energy scale. If you were away from four dimensions, it would have a power law dependence on the energy scale. Yes, so, okay. Yes.
I'm sorry, I've forgotten a lot of things. So this vector potential is that is the field, like just like in ENM, the vector, like when we quantize it, we treat it as the field theory of a vector potential.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is instead of like a vector, what we have is a set of the algebra elements.
It's a vector with lots of indices. So you could think of it as follows. So in electromagnetism, you have A mu. So you have one field. So this would be, if you're familiar with this language, when the gauge group is U1. When you have a more general, in non-abelian gauge theories, the gauge field is actually a matrix. And we'll come back to this later, because it's going to be important when we develop the rules for Lagrangian expansion. But just to anticipate, mu now is an n by n matrix. So you have to quantize these n by n fields, n square fields.
So in ENM, the field at one point is a four tuple field numbers.
And yes. In the angles theory, the field at one point will be a four tuple of the algebra elements?
You have n square fields. Yeah. Because I and j, this is a matrix, right? So.
Oh, okay. So you're treating them as a bunch of scalar fields, rather as a single field whose values are the algebra elements.
It depends what you feel most comfortable. You could think of it as a vector field with n squared component, or it's essentially the same thing that you're saying. This is being a Lie algebra element. That means the Hermitian n by n matrix for when the gauge group is U(n). Any other questions? Okay, so just to finish this very important property of quantum field theories and of gate theories in particular, where we have logarithmic running of the coupling with the energy scale, we were saying that quantum effects modify the propagator of the theory, which means that since the propagator is the thing that multiplies G squared, modifies the coupling constant. We already saw that the cubic self-interaction of Young-Mills here gives rise to this diagram, but we also have a contribution where a gluon pair creates a quark and anti-quark and continues like that. Okay. And if you have more matter fields, you would have more diagrams. Essentially, this V0 encapsulates the effect of all matter fields, including the gluons, to the running, to the quantum propagator, essentially. Okay? Now, if we study a theory, so far I didn't really specify any much details about what this theory is, but if we say that the theory has gauge group SUN, in very pedestrian languages, this just means that A mu, the gauge field, what kind of matrix is this? Can anyone tell me? M by N is Hermitian triplet, precisely. Very good. Hermitian. Okay. And imagine we have quarks. So I and J run from 1 to N. Q, you should think of it as a row vector. So this is a matrix, this is a row vector. And A just counts how many types of fermions we have. So it goes from 1 to NF. That's usually called the number of flavors that the gauge theory has. Okay. So for such a theory, you've seen in your lecture that this number, what this number is, it actually counts the effective degrees of freedom that are running inside the loops here. And B0 is given by 11/3 N minus 2/3 NF, okay? And the fact that B0 is different from zero tells us that, in fact, the coupling constant runs with the energy scale. No matter what, the coupling constant will get large at some low energies in this particular case. Because of the sign here, the fact that the beta function is negative means that the coupling constant is weak at very large energies and gets necessarily strong at low energies. Okay. So at low energies, you will never be able to trust perturbation theory. Okay. So then we're stuck. How are we ever going to make progress on QCD or Young-Mills theory if you want to study the theory around what's called the QCD scale, which is the scale of the mass of the hadrons? At that scale, the effective coupling is of order 1. We're cooked. So then Tuff had this brilliant, brilliant idea, which at first sight sounds crazy, but we will see they have really remarkable features. So the idea is to do the following. So actually, if we were doing QCD, the gauge group of QCD is what? SU3. So his idea was, let's study QCD by first enriching the theory and going from SU3, generalizing the theory from SU3 to SUN. The Lagrangian, as I've written it down, looks exactly the same. The only thing that will change is that now A is, instead of being 3x3 matrices, Hermitian traceless matrices, will be N by N. And Q, instead of being a column vector with 3 entries, will be a column vector with N entries. Now, superficially, this looks like a bad idea, because if this theory was strongly coupled to begin with, and I'm adding more degrees of freedom, wouldn't the theory become more strongly coupled? And the answer is yes. But the issue that he has is that there exists a limit. It's called the Tuft limit. Where things simplify. Theory simplifies. Okay. And what will happen, remarkably, is that even though we started with a theory that had no expansion parameter, what we will show is that the theory acquires an expansion parameter, which in fact is going to be a power series expansion in 1 over n. So now we have a small parameter, and we can calculate. And that's what physicists like to do. And we can try to approach real QCD, which has gauge group SU3, by starting from the n equals infinity theory that we can, in some cases, solve, and then do a 1 over n expansion towards QCD. That's the idea. What we will see, very remarkably, is that when you write the theory in this particular limit, in the Tuft limit, the expansion resembles perturbative string theory. Where the coupling constant of string theory is 1 over n. Remember that the perturbative expansion of string theory is given by an expansion in terms of two-dimensional surfaces with increased number of handles. So for example, if you want to compute the vacuum energy of string theory, you would start to living order in perturbation theory, you would have the sphere diagram. Which goes like g string to the minus 2. Then you would have the torus, which goes like g string to the 0. Then you have what's two-handled Riemann surface, which goes like g string squared, so on. Have you seen this expansion in string theory, at least the idea that all observable have an expansion in terms of two-dimensional surfaces with increasing number of handles? That's familiar?
It's been very fast.
Very fast? Well, so I don't expect you to know how to calculate a genus 2, it's called genus 2, because it has two handles, a genus 2 perturbative string theory amplitude. But at least together, right now, what will be important for us is that all observables have a natural expansion like this. And in fact, that observables, the power of g-string of any given diagram in string theory goes like 2i's h minus 2, where h is the number of handles. I think you've seen, that much you've seen probably. Okay. What's beautiful about string theory, in a way, that at any given loop order, say for the vacuum diagram, there is only one diagram to compute, the torus. At two loops, you have this surface, and that's it. While in quantum field theory, you would have a whole ton of diagrams that you would have to sum over. So what we want to work towards is to show that this Tuft large N expansion will look exactly like an expansion over two-dimensional surfaces with increasing number of handles, okay? And that's how we're going to connect the first hint of a connection between gauge theory and string theory. So from here, we're going to see that there is a tantalizing connection between gauge theories and string theories. And ADS-CFT will be a kind of brilliant realization of this idea by giving a very specific setup where explicit four-dimensional gauge theories will have an explicit description in terms of string theories. Any questions so far about this? Because now I'm going to start with the nitty-gritty details of how to do this large N expansion in Young-Mills or gauge theories. It should be said that apart from Tuft giving us this beautiful connection between string theory and gauge theories, the actual 1 over n expansion actually also has some successful phenomenological features that are valid for QCD for the physics of mesons and baryons. But we will not go into that because our main interest will be to really understand this connection. When should I stop? Half past? Okay, good. Okay, so let's now do large encounting. Excuse me. Yes.
Why a string state is a point on a on this object?
String state. No. What I was saying is this: that imagine you want to compute four particles scattering. I want to put external particles so that it's not just a vacuum diagram. Imperturbative string theory. So the idea of perturbative string theory is that we have a string, a two-dimensional surface that propagates along spacetime. And so first, if the strings were point-like, in field theory, the four-point function of four particles scattering would be given by something like this. You have two particles coming in, two coming out, and here you could have a complicated vertex that the theory allows, and you have to sum over all those vertices. The statement about string theory is that if you want to compute, say, the scattering of, say, four gravitons. So you have a graviton coming in from infinity, two of them coming from infinity, they interact and they continue and they go back to infinity. This will be the leading order result. This will be the analog in quantum field theory to the three-level result. So if you have a vertex in quantum field theory that is a phi to the fourth vertex, you want to compute the four-particle interaction to leading order, you would get this. Right? You have a lambda phi to the fourth theory. You have a vertex that allows you to connect these four points. Now, to next to leading order, actually, let me do phi cube theory because it's a bit more similar to this, to the perturbative expansion in string theory. So what's the leading order diagram in a phi cube theory? It would be this one. This is a one loop diagram, okay? Because I'm integrating over the virtual momentum running in this loop. In string theory, the analog of this would be the two strings come in. Notice what's happening here. You have two particles coming in. You pair create two, annihilate them, and then you have two coming out. Yes. Sorry, this is phi-4. What am I doing? Yes. So phi cube would be what? Can anyone tell me what the phi cube diagram would be? Which one? Okay, let me do phi to the fourth. I think we're really clear. The analogy. Now, a loop diagram is one where you have now virtual particles that are created. They live for a while, and then they die. And you can think of time flowing this way. So here you have two strings merging to a single string, and then splitting again into two strings. Okay. Now, if you want to draw a diagram that has an intermediate virtual string, you would draw this. You have a string propagating, but then at this location, it splits into two, and then it goes back like that. Okay? This will be the leading order correction to the scattering of four strings, one loop. Okay. Now it's clear, by analogy, that if I start drawing more handles into the surface, I will get more and more. I can get more and more intermediate states, and that's how you develop the string perturbation theory. The thing that you should know about this is that This follows from analyzing the properties of the string world seat action, of the Polyakov action, is that the weight of a given diagram is exactly as I said here, which is. Okay. Any other questions about this? Okay. Okay, so let's do the large n counting. As I said before, the idea is to upgrade matrices from 3 × 3 to n by n. And in order not to obscure what new ingredients the large n counting adds beyond the usual Feynman diagrams of quantum field theory, it is convenient to consider the larger expansion of a matrix model. So I want to disentangle the complications of perturbative expansions associated to the fact that you have virtual loop momenta and that you have a higher dimensional quantum field theory to the details that arise because now you have n by n matrices. Okay? And a matrix model is essentially a zero-dimensional quantum field theory. So these are created by fields that, if you wish, they live at one space-time point. Okay? More formally, the path integral of such a matrix integral would be like this. So if this was a higher dimensional quantum field theory, here, when I have the action, you would integrate the Lagrangian density over space-time. Here we're doing a zero-dimensional quantum field theory. So you just have to write down the fields, essentially. There is no space-time to integrate over. There is only one point. So what you have here is trace m squared plus lambda cubed, a cubic interaction plus a quartic interaction, etc., where m ij is an n by n Hermitian matrix. For simplicity, I have eliminated the condition that the matrix has to be traceless. This is anyway the difference between the expansion when the theory, when the matrix is traceless or not, is not important in the large, in the leading large n limit. It becomes important in the subleading terms in the expansion. So let's consider this for simplicity. To make connection with what we were saying before in terms of a gauge group, when you remove the traceless condition, it just says that this M is an element of UN. As opposed to SSUN. Are people familiar with UN as UN? Yes? Okay. Very good. Notice. Sorry?
You mean it's the algebra?
Well, so the fact that MIJ is an n by n Hermitian matrix is totally equivalent to saying that M is an element of UN Lie algebra. To elaborate this more, or okay, I think I will, because let me just in two words tell you why what I said is true. First of all, let's start. What are the unitary matrices? N by n unitary matrices. These are n by n complex. So they're complex, invertible. They satisfy the property. So let's call this matrix U.
What does it mean in that
IM is an element of the Lyapunov group UN?
Sorry?
Do you mean that I times M is an element of the Lyapunov group UN?
I times M. Sorry, I'm
when we exponentiate them, we exponentiate it times I.
Oh.
Exponential of I times that.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so invertible satisfies the fact that it's unitary means that U times the Hermitian conjugate is the identity matrix. Now, in order to get the Lie algebra out of this matrix, what you do is you represent these unitary matrices as exponential of some other matrices T. Okay. You are familiar with this from quantum mechanics. You know that you can represent an SU2 rotation in quantum mechanics by, so for SU2, you can represent a rotation by exponentiating the Pauli matrices. This is just a generalization of this idea. Now, if I plug in this condition and I put here a small parameter, and I plug in this parameterization of a unitary matrix into this condition, what you find is, well, first you get one, okay, let me do it in two steps. The leading order term in epsilon vanishes, you have one equals one. And the leading order in epsilon tells you that T equals T dagger. So T, which are the elements, what's called in the Lie algebra, when we're talking about unitary matrices, the corresponding elements of the Lie algebra, which are the matrices that you get by exponentiating it, have to be Hermitian, okay? Okay, good. We're not gonna use, we're really gonna make explicit the fact that these things are matrices. So whenever we write down a term in the Lagrangian like 3s m squared, 3s m trace m cubed, we're gonna make explicit that this is matrix multiplication. So I'm gonna have mij is mji, right? Or if I have trace m cubed, this is mij, mjk, mki. I'm just multiplying matrices together and taking the trace at the end. Now, it is very convenient to represent this matrix multiplication graphically by essentially following what the various row and column indices are doing. So if I write, I can represent trace m squared, or let me do trace m cubed, say, by this. So this is the product of three matrices. But notice that each index, each row index of a given matrix is married to the consecutive, or column index is married to the row index of the consecutive matrix, and so on. So what you do is you follow the flow of the matrix indices. So you can represent this like that. So let me see what convention I'm going to choose. So imagine you start here. Start with this guy. This guy, so you have a matrix here, Mij, connects. So this is a column index of this M, connects with a row index of the consecutive matrix M here. So you have JJ. Now, outgoing is a column index K that connects with a row index of the next matrix. And now you have I that goes into I. Okay? Is the basic idea of this clear? So essentially what you do is you follow the indices of multiplication like that, and you put arrows. The convention I've chosen here, it's completely irrelevant whether you choose the other one, is that an arrow goes from a column index to a row index, okay? So if an edge here is outgoing, has an outgoing arrow, this represented the column index. If it's incoming, it represented a row index. Okay. So this is just a convenient way of drawing matrix multiplication. So what you do is you follow the path like that, and that's how you multiply things. The fact that things close is a statement that, that there are no free indices here. All indices in the matrix are contracted, and that's what this picture is trying to represent, that all indices are really contracted in one single object. OK, so now let's develop some Feynman rules for this. So in order to follow the Feynman rules, first we need the propagator, and then the vertices. The propagator, as usual, you get by looking at the quadratic part of the action. So you have m squared, m cubed, and so on. But for the propagator, it's sufficient to look at this term. Okay. Notice that since we're in zero dimensions, usually in quantum field theory, you would have derivatives of fields. But since we're going to zero dimensions, there are no derivatives. Adding derivatives. Doing exactly the same thing I'm doing now in higher dimensions is completely trivial to extend. But let's do it now. Let's not do that, just to focus on the properties of the Lagrangian expansion. Later, we'll upgrade this to four-dimensional gauge theories. So essentially, what I want to compute is the propagator. I want to compute if I take two fields, two matrices like that, what is their propagator? If these were not matrices, if this was just a lambda phi cube theory, you would represent the propagator by a single line, right? And you would say that the propagator is proportional to g squared. Okay. Now, in this theory, we have to find how you couple two arbitrary elements of these Hermitian matrices. And the way you do that, or one way to do that, should I go through the details of that? Well, let me write the answer, and then I'll tell you how you can do it, or maybe you know how to do it, and then I don't have to even explain it. Remember that essentially when you compute the propagator, you have to invert, roughly speaking, the what's sitting in front of the quadratic term in the Lagrangian. So that means that so you have a 1 over g squared multiplying m squared, the propagator will be proportional to g squared. Okay, and now you have to decide how this, or you have to compute how the various indices of this n by n matrix couple to each other. And not surprisingly, it's given by a bunch of Kronecker deltas. So the propagator will be non-zero if this index, the row index of the first matrix, equals the column index of the second. So you have delta I L. And if the column index of the first matrix agrees with the row index of the second one. Okay, so this is the propagator of the theory. And you can write it graphically like this. So in my convention, J is a column index. So you have at going. This has to connect by this rule to K, which is a row index. So that's why it's an incoming arrow. And then you have L going to I. This is a graphical representation of that specifies the flow of indices and that generalizes the usual propagator, single line propagator that you would write down in lambda phi cube theory. Would people know how to derive this, or should I do it? Do it? Yeah, OK. Let me do it here. Let me tell you kind of a simple way of deriving the propagator of a theory. The propagator, after all, is nothing but the expectation value of this operator in the Gaussian theory, where you drop the higher level interactions. This is the three-level propagator, right? So one way of doing it is to say, this is a nice trick. So I don't know if you've seen it in the lecture, but you start with the original integral. Of course, we're now dropping the interactions because we're just interested in the propagators. And you do the, you write down the following total derivative of suitably written here object. So M I J. And now I'm going to write down the Lagrangian of the theory, which is 1. Well, I guess I want a 1/2 to really be precise. And I'm going to write this as M, M, N, M, N, M. OK? So first of all, what is this? I have an kind of a path integral. Okay, if these were functions, I have an integral of a total derivative. What is that? Well, modulo boundary terms, this is 0, right? So now we're going to get a nice expression by computing the action of this operator when it acts on this guy and when it acts on that guy. So when it acts on this guy, we use the following variational rule, which you've seen in the quantum field theory class. The only difference now is that we have n squared sub fields. I use that the functional derivative of the matrix or the field Mij with respect to MLK is delta IL delta JK. That's the statement that you get 0 unless the guy upstairs is exactly the guy downstairs. Okay, that's kind of a obvious definition of what you mean by differentiating this with respect to this. There will be 0 unless the two guys are identical. Okay. So that means that when I calculate this, the first term is going to give me a delta this delta function, essentially. So this derivative will either act here or will act here. If it acts here, you're going to get delta IL delta KJ plus, okay, minus. Now this guy has to act here. What this will do is bring down 1 power of m. Think of what's the derivative of a Gaussian. It's x essentially times the Gaussian. So what this will give me is, and notice, and I'll leave this as an exercise to check, it's very simple, that it doesn't matter the least bit whether this guy acts on the first matrix or the second one. Just like the derivative. If I differentiate exponential of minus 1/2 x squared, you can get x times exponential. So this is exactly the same. So you're going to get 1 over g squared. And now the expectation value, because when I differentiate, I bring down 1 m, but still have the Gaussian integral to do. And that's precisely the definition of what I mean by this bra and ket. Is m I j. Now, if you add the derivative here, you can convince yourself that this is precisely, using this rule, nothing more than this rule, you get this. But we said that this is the integral of a total derivative, so this is 0. And this is exactly the propagator. Is this manipulation more or less clear? Okay. And you can do this for any theory. That's one efficient way of extracting the propagator for any field theory. Okay. Yeah, so strictly speaking, you would have to divide by the Gaussian integral itself. Yeah. That's a good point. Okay. So we extracted the propagator. I need more blackboards. No problem. Don't hit me, okay? Okay, so we have the propagator. Now, what is the interaction vertex? If the theory was lambda phi cubed, you know that you can essentially read the Feynman rules by just looking at the Lagrangian. So if you have lambda phi cubed, if the theory was lambda phi cubed, you would have a three-point vertex like that. We have 3 phi fields coming in. Now we have essentially the same thing, but now we have to take care of precisely the flow of indices, of matrix indices, which I've erased. But Now, using the rules I told you before, the m cubed, the 3m cubed term in the Lagrangian gives rise to the following. So let me make sure I use the same conventions here. So as I wrote it before, it's like this. Okay. So you have a cubic vertex which has three free ends. Another way you would compute Feynman diagrams would be by connecting all possible three-point vertices like that with propagators. Okay. In order to make it more explicit, one way you can think of it is that this object is prepared to attach with matrices which have indices i1, j1, i2. So imagine I have three matrices, m1, m2, m3, with indices ij, ij, i2, and so on. One way of saying it is that this vertex is proportional. So this vertex will be non-zero unless this guy equals this guy. So this vertex will be proportional to delta J1, A2, delta J2, I3, delta J3, I1. So the Feynman rules of this matrix model, matrix theories, is created by a whole bunch of Kronecker deltas. The propagators have a whole bunch of deltas. The vertices have a whole bunch of deltas. And when you construct a Feynman diagram, essentially you have to glue the vertices to each other via propagators, always respecting the flow of indices. This is just the statement that the theory should be, you should only look at observables that are, I want to, gauge invariant is the word. These are observables that are invariant under unitary transformations. Are the Feynman rules clear, more or less clear? OK, so let me maybe just give you a flavor of how to build up the expansion. And we would essentially want to start seeing Riemann surfaces coming out of the Lardin expansion of this theory. So for simplicity, let's consider the cubic theory. And let's compute the free energy of the theory. So this would be given by Feynman diagrams that are connected and that have no external lines. That's the definition of what the free energy is. Essentially, you define it by saying that the partition function of the theory is the exponential of minus the free energy. And F is a sum over connected diagrams. So what's the leading contribution? Well, the leading contribution will arise from, remember that I have to draw closed diagrams by putting together this guy, so rule number one and rule number two. And actually, in order to maybe make things a little bit more familiar to the standard normalization that you've seen probably in the course, I can trivially rescale M in such a way that instead of G squared appearing outside the action, it appears here. Okay? You can move G up around and it doesn't make the least bit of difference. If this was a lambda phi to a cube theory, what would be the leading contribution to the free energy? What diagram would it be?
The tree.
Well, this, there are no external lines in this diagram. So what you would do, how would you do it? So the leading order term would be to look at the propagator Notable will have one external line. No, it's just this, a loop. You take a propagator and you attach the two ends of the propagator. That's the leading order result. Now let's draw this in the double line notation. By the way, this notation of drawing things like that is called double line notation, Dubbs notation. The diagrams that you get by gluing together these kind of ribbon diagrams, or they're also called. Putting together these things are called ribbon diagrams, essentially, for the obvious reason that these look like a little bit like a ribbon. So now, in the m to the cube theory, what you have to do is essentially close the propagator consistently. So what you would have is this times this, because you would have, say, j and I. Another way of saying it, maybe more explicitly, is that this would be proportional, given what I have here, this would be proportional to delta. In order to close, L has to equal I, right? So I have to put L equals I. In order to close it, K has to equal J. So have JJ. And remember that whenever we do Feynman diagrams, we sum over everything that runs in the vertices. You have to sum over momenta, which in this case we don't have because we are in zero dimensions. But you also have to sum over all the quantum numbers of all the particles that are running in the loop. So that means that this diagram is, first you do the combinatorics, you close the loop, and then you sum over all possible species of particles that can run there. So what this would be proportional to? So n squared, right? So you would get n from here and n from here, so this is proportional to n squared. So if we're in the large n limit, this diagram is very large and dominates. Now let's do a more interesting diagram. If we were doing lambda phi cube theory, what would be the next leading order contribution to the free energy? Can anyone tell me what the diagram looks like? Sorry? Gray? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the word. Maybe you're right.
Nice. I was in 5 points.
Maybe a loop in a loop?
A loop in a loop.
Kind
of like a disconnected diagram. So remember that I'm looking at the free energy is a sum of connected diagrams. Mm-hmm. So all parts of the diagram should be connected.
Like
a
B-shaped.
Sorry?
B-shaped.
B?
Capital B. Kind of.
This looks like a quantic interaction.
Well, you just call B-shaped.
Okay, so maybe what you want to say is it's more like a dumbbell. To leading order in lambda, so notice, why is there a contribution to leading order in lambda? So you have a vertex. Well, if you have this leading vertex, you can never draw a closed diagram like this. Because if you do it like that, you still have this open edge. That doesn't correspond to the free energy. Another way of saying it is that in more pedestrian language, the integral of x cubed e to the minus 1/2 x squared is 0. So if you have an odd number of fields in the integral, this will vanish. So that's why the first non-trivial result comes when you have two vertices. So you have 6 fields, and now you can connect the 6 fields together, which is what I've done here. So let me just conclude by drawing, and I'll start the lecture tomorrow by going through this again. What would be the corresponding diagram if we now glued vertices using the matrix, the ribbon graph? There are essentially two types of vertices, and you should now play around and see how many inequivalent vertices you can draw. There is one that essentially looks like this, so you would take. This is another way of representing this vertex, right? You have three lines that are ready to attach to something. This is another cubic vertex. You should think of the cubic vertex kind of as living here. It attaches to three lines, right? And now you can close the diagram like this. And if you follow the arrows, it always flows consistently. So you always have an arrow flowing one way next to an arrow flowing the other way. That's just a statement that you have a matrix with one row and one column, and they flow differently. Sorry,
you're right. You're small right circle.
Oh, here I'm missing it, yes. Thank you. Okay, so now let's count. What would this be proportional to? So imagine I had put here the indices more carefully, and I had, okay, let me do it one more time. And I had here index I, index j, index k, attaching to index L, index M, index N. So I can attach them if now I have to sum over all the quantum numbers associated to its matrix. So sum over all values of J, K, I, L, M, N. And now I start contracting. So that will give me delta I L square, because I connects with L in this diagram, right? But N is here. L goes like that, so it also connects with I. So I get delta I L square. I'll get delta J M square. And I'll get delta K N square. And remember, I have to sum over everything. I, J, K, L, M N. But this is nothing to delta II, delta JJ, delta KK, because delta IL square is just delta II, the same here and the same here. So this is proportional to N cubed. Okay? So this diagram is proportional to N cubed, but I have two interaction vertices, right? So it's proportional to g squared. So it's proportional to g squared n cubed, which I will write as, and you'll see later why, g squared n times n squared. Remember that the original diagram was proportional to n squared. The next leading diagram is proportional to n squared times the product of g squared n times n. Notice here that the basic rule to decide the large n counting is that whenever you see a closed index loop, is essentially delta II, and you get a factor of n. So when you draw the diagram, the trick to know the large n, the behavior with n, is you just count the closed index loops, and that gives you n to the number of index loops. So in this case, you have 1, 2, 3, you get n cubed. Here you have 2, you get n squared. Okay? Let me just draw one diagram, and that's where I'll start next lecture. So these so far are the two basic diagrams. There is another one that you can draw at this order in perturbation theory. And then we'll start seeing that something interesting happens. The problem is these are harder to draw, but I'll try. So luckily, the ones that are hard to draw are the ones that are the least important ones in the large n limit. So this is fantastic. I'm making a mess. So let's see. Not even close. Let me start again, sorry. Maybe, given the time, maybe I should start next week. Sorry? Learn tutorial, okay, very good. Sorry? Okay.